So I'm working mostly on spinform models and the renormalization group. So how to do renormalization in quantum gravity. So I just write this like spin foams and RG, and like where RG is like the renormalization group. And I'm a postdoc here since 2017, and I did my PhD partly here at PI together with Bianca Dittrich. So many of the things I will be talking about is something that Bianca is working on as well. And many of the concepts that we have developed is together with her. And today is just mostly conceptual, so I will try to give you an idea how renormalization in spinform models work. So just to just briefly mention again, so you know, spinform quantum gravity is a path integral approach to quantum gravity. So we try to implement a sum over geometries, and it's background independent. It doesn't make any kind of reference to a background structure. So have you seen a spinform model during your course? In three dimensions, right? The Ponsano-Reggi model, which is for three dimensions, Euclidean with vanishing cosmological constant. So what I'm interested in these models are three things. So one thing is the what I would call the background independent renormalization. And this is important if you want to learn something about the dynamics of the system. The second part is going towards observables. And from those, I would like to learn something about what are the properties of this quantum spacetime. So if you say they have a superposition of geometries, what does it actually mean physically? So we want to work towards that. So what are the properties of a quantum spacetime? And then the last thing, in order to do all these things, to do renormalization or to compute observables, you need numerical techniques. Because you can consider spinforms like basically many-body systems from which you want to compute their non-perturbative dynamics. And today I want just to focus on this background-independent RG, what this means, and how this works, and why is this very important for spinform models. And just what I'm going to present you today is one interpretation how to do this in spinform models. The other interpretation would be something that you formulate in quantum in group field theory, but I'm not going to talk about this today. So if you want to know more about this, you can ask Sylvain in this very building. And so basically, so in spinform models, you face two challenges. On the one hand, in order to define this path integral at all, you have to introduce a lattice, a regulator. You have to truncate the number of degrees of freedom to finite ones. So you introduce a lattice as a regulator. And this comes with two problems. On the one hand, nothing in your theory tells you which lattice you should choose, and your results depend on the choice that you have made. So because this is some artificial choice, you have to think about how can your predictions, your results, be independent of the choice that you have made. So you have to think about how to remove this regulator. And the second important point is that because you've introduced the lattice, diffeomorphism symmetry is broken. So if you want to recover GR in what kind of limit that would still need to be defined, you somehow have to recover diffeomorphism symmetry. And the second point is, because it's background independent, you don't have a background spacetime structure. So you have nothing that tells you what lengths actually are, because you sum over geometries, and these geometries are fluctuating. So you have also varying length scales. So because it's background independent, you have no scale available. So for example, no lattice scale. So what does this mean? So just think about the following, that I give you, for example, three different kinds of lattices. So I give you either a very coarse one, I give you one which is a little bit more refined, and then I give you a third one that is even finer. Right? And in principle, this is like a choice that you can make. Nothing in your theory tells you what to do. And if you are in lattice gauge theory, this is your spacetime. Right? You have discretized your spacetime, and because you have this background structure, your theory can tells you, look, this is like a certain distance a. This is your lattice spacing. However, in this kind of in this theory, you have a different lattice spacing, which is larger than this, and here you have an even larger lattice spacing. And you just assume that you are just ignoring all the dynamics that happens below the lattice scale, and you have this theory defined at this particular scale. But you don't really want your physics to depend on what kind of choice you have made. So if you make a calculation here about physics that is relevant at this scale, it shouldn't. You should be able to do the same calculation over here and get the same results, right? So, or at least consistent results. And usually what people do is that when you have your lattice scale, or you have your various lattice scales, you have to change the theory that you assign to the various lattices. So lattice gauge theory usually have a coupling constant. So for example, here you would have a coupling constant g. Whereas on this lattice, you have to assign a different coupling constant, which is a g prime, and over here, a g double prime. So in that sense, you have a renormalization group flow by assigning different theories to different scales of your system, by having a basically a coupling constant that is depending then basic or that is basically dependent on your lattice scale. And so you would have a flow from the ultraviolet right here, so shorter scales, to larger scales, and you change your theory accordingly that you assign to those lattices in order to have consistent results. Now, in the situation in spin form models is rather different. So you can draw the same kinds of lattices, but now what you have is not a lattice scale. You just have your various different lattices. So, for example, I can say that I start on this right-hand side, and I assign an amplitude. You know, you take your favorite spin-form model, and you assign an amplitude to these various objects, and you evaluate it to be, for example, this. So it's like just an amplitude you assign to this particular system. So, but you won't like to do the same calculation on a different lattice. So if you take the same amplitude assigned now to this one, so by amplitude, I just mean that you have this, for example, vertex amplitudes. You would assign that to the various vertices in here. And then you would try to do the same here. And you probably won't get the same result. So what you would like to do is you would have an assignment of amplitudes across the various lattices such that you get consistent results. For example, that your expectation values of observables agree. And one thing you can do this is by performing a coarse graining flow. So the idea is that you have a coarse graining flow. For example, that you would say that on here you have finer degrees of freedom, for example, those. I'm not sure whether you can see this, but for example, those that you would like to integrate out in order to arrive at an effective amplitude on the coarser lattice. So basically, you have an identification of what are fine degrees of freedom versus coarse degrees of freedom. And you want to define now a flow by integrating out the fine degrees of freedom here in the fine lattice and derive an effective new amplitude for this coarser lattice. And then you repeat those structure, or you repeat this procedure, and you arrive, or you derive new effective amplitudes for your coarser lattices. And the idea behind this is that you basically assign a family of amplitudes to a family of lattices. So what was the scale in lattice gauge theory before is now replaced by the fineness of your lattice. So you have more degrees of freedom here. And if you go coarser, you have less degrees of freedom. And you have to make according choices for your amplitudes that you assign to that. And the coarse graining flow, exactly this identification of what are coarse degrees of freedom and what are fine degrees of freedom, is a way to derive an effective amplitude. And so just to reiterate, what you want to do is assign a family of amplitudes. To your various lattices, and the this is basically the RG flow, and what was ultraviolet before now is just fine lattices, and infrared goes towards coarse lattices. Now you might think, well, how can we then remove this lattice? So in principle, we would like to know the entire flow of these kinds of amplitudes. So we would like to know it from the finest possible lattices to the coarsest ones. And this is usually something which is very difficult to do. But one thing we are particularly looking for are fixed points of this flow. So if you would imagine that you have a particular amplitude, you perform this procedure, and you arrive at the same amplitude again. So no matter how many degrees of freedom you have, you would have you get the same amplitude on those constant lattices, which is, for example, something that you have in the Ponsano-Reggie model. The Ponsano-Reggie model is triangulation independent, so you can perform changes of the triangulation, and you still have the same amplitudes assigned to them. But we are looking at something which is more interesting, because the Ponsano-Reggie model is topological. And we're looking for something like particular second-order phase transitions in this kind of flow. Because second-order phase transitions have the particular property that the theory becomes scale invariant. So precisely what we are looking for, that it doesn't depend on these choices that we have made here. And at the same time, you get propagating degrees of freedom. So when you look for this kind of phase transition, the idea is that you can perform the continuum limit or the continuum limit on this kind of phase transition. And it's usually very non-trivial to find this because, or you may know this from example from the Ising model, which has a second order phase transition between this ordered and the disordered phase, where the correlation length diverges and all the degrees of freedom in the system become correlated. So So this is what one would like to look for in order to remove the lattice, and which a non-trivial continuum theory would be expected. And the second important conjecture that we have for a very long time is that precisely at such a point, so where you basically find a theory which is independent of your lattices, you also reobtain diffeomorphism symmetry, which has to do with something called a vertex translation symmetry, which is like a discrete remnant of that symmetry. If you have questions, you can ask me later a bit more about this. And just to give you a taste about how this might work, because so far I was just conceptual, and this is something where you have to introduce some kind of approximations if you want to do this in practice, right? So you have to make some kind of choices, how this coarse graining works, et cetera, et cetera. And just one example, one of my works that might want to look at, which is together with Benjamin Barr, is this article, which is also a very short one. And in this work, we have taken the EPIL FK model in four dimensions. So we have two of the main people involved in this, with Laurent and Etara, who worked on this model. We have taken a restricted model with very semi-classical, but we computed basically observables for two different discretizations and compared them, and defined a renormalization group flow with that. And we found indications in this for a second order phase transition, and which the second order phase transition, or well, or also with the case that there was a UV attractor fixed point on which diffeomorphism symmetry might be restored. So the problem is, like, this is a very ambitious program that you want to implement. And right now, what you need to do is, for at least for the moment, implement approximations and use numerical techniques to make this work. But the program shows, like, promise in the sense that there are positive signs that this can actually work, and you can define, or you can find a non-trivial continuum theory from this. So yeah, I guess I'm out of time now, and but there's still a bit of time for questions. So yeah.
So is the expectation that these fixed points correspond to, like, our physical world, because that's where the diffeomorphism invariance is recovered?
Well, that is what we want to figure out. So, I mean, the spinform models are derived from general relativity in a particular way, but, you know, you make lots of approximations. You discretize the theory, and you have to make sure that you recover at least general relativity in a suitable limit. And that is something that we know for a single building block, where you can define a semi-classical limit, you find discrete gravity, essentially. What happens for larger building blocks, is we do not know yet, and that is, like, part of this research program.
So when you do this RG in spin foams, you get also a running of Newton's constant and the cosmological constant, or?
In principle, yes. So I had some article last year where we implemented those, but, you know, implementing Newton's constant is kind of tricky in spinform models. So usually you can try and implement it via boundary conditions on the boundary states. Cosmological constant you get as well. And in principle, you can also have flows in these parameters. Mm-hmm.
But you still don't have, like, the beta functions,
Well, not explicitly, no. But also we don't have the nice diagrams as they have in asymptotic safety. But in principle, we would like to have to arrive at those, yeah. So which is something, like, which you can also say is, in principle, you can get the same kind of logic as you have in lattice gauge theory, that you have certain coupling constant or parameters of your model that flow under renormalization. So there you would make basically a choice of what your amplitude looks like in terms of its shape or its form, which you could call a theory space. And then you perform this operation, and usually you get out of this theory space, so you have some kind of other terms that arise, and you can try to find a projection back onto the theory space, and then use this as a flow in terms of these parameters.
So I don't know if this model is that equivalent to some lattice gauge theory of several dimensions, several gauge group? What gauge group and what dimensions?
So the studies that we did was in four dimensions, and it was for SO4, so Euclidean gravity. And spin foams are related to lattice gauge theories, but they are more general.
So the lattice gauge theory, SO4 lattice gauge theory in four dimensions, it has what kind of phase transitions?
I don't know, honestly. I mean, but I would suspect, because it's non-abelian, that it probably has no phase transition.
But if you're in 4D, it's possible. Is that possible to have a phase transition?
I mean, this is, like, a very different model than the lattice gauge theory. It's more general in the sense that you allow for more variations in terms of your degrees of freedom. You can write them in the same form. As a lattice gauge theory and spin foams, you can write them in the same form, but spin foams allow for more, or are more restrictive in the terms of degrees of freedom that they have. So you make a certain choice on the intertwiners, which is related to the so-called simplicity constraints. So it is a much more general theory.
Thanks, Sebastian.
So hi. So I work in quantum gravity. I work in Lyon, in France, at L'École Normale Supérieure. But I've been visiting the Parameter Institute since I was a postdoc here in 2003, 2006. And I'm visiting here for 1 year now. but soon finishing this summer. So how did I get work on quantum gravity? It all started long, long time ago. I was an undergraduate student, and I loved math, and I was reading books on particle physics and sci-fi stuff. I really like all that stuff. And I went for a research project in Observatoire de Paris, where a guy got me to work on neutron stars and looking at the different equation of states and the stability of neutron star and the rotations. And it's the first time I discovered general relativity. So he gave me a big book, the gravitation book, the big black book, and tell me, learn GR and the 3+1 decomposition. Okay, it was a beautiful project. Next year, I went to Cambridge and I discovered quantum field theory and supersymmetry. The guy gave me as project to look at instantonic solution in n equal to 2 supergravity. So it was another experience. And then I did my master's, and I went to researchers in my lab. And one of them was Pascal De Giovanni, who gave me this crazy project to a student that was just discovering quantum field theory to look at the one-dimensional defects in 2D conformal field theory. So looking at CFT at La Cigale and 1D defects, which now we just call them edge modes, which are still not understood. So that was 2000 and something. And so basically, what I'd like to say about quantum gravity, it's just a series of things I don't understand and things I had to learn on the spot. So that's mainly that I'm going to talk about. So after that, I went to my next research project was in Imperial College with Lee Smolin. And he got me to work on string theory. So I looked at the BFSS and IKTT matrix models for strings. So I don't know if you ever heard about these things, but basically it's a background independent approach to string theory where you write some action for D0 brain, so point defects, and you try to look at condensation of this D0 brain to form the 11 dimensional geometry. And so then it was the time to choose PhD thesis. So I really want to do strings. I was looking for strings, and I found loops instead. So I went to Marseille to work with Carlo Rovelli. Lee Smolin was also working on loops. And in my lab in Lyon, there was also Laurent Fredel. So it was a natural thing to do. So I started working on loop quantum gravity. So I think you had some course on loop quantum gravity. So I'll just tell you what my vision of loop quantum gravity is. So loop quantum gravity, it's a Hamiltonian formalism for quantum gravity. So it means you rely on a 3+1 decomposition of a space-time, and you have your 3D quantum space with states of quantum geometry. And you make this evolve in time by solving the Hamiltonian constraints. So it's a totally background independent formalism where you try to define quanta of geometries and you try to see how they form an overall geometry of space and of space-time. And so technically you quantize the Hamiltonian constraints of general relativity and you try to solve them. And these Hamiltonian constraints generate space-time diffeomorphisms. So basically, what you're doing in loop quantum gravity is that you're defining states of quantum geometry, you're trying to define some quantum equivalent of a space-time diffeomorphism, and try to identify physical states of the quantum geometry satisfying the quantum diffeomorphism constraints. And once you've done that, you've realized that you're totally background independent, and you don't know how to localize things anymore. And so you have to understand what's a quantum coordinate system, and how to reintroduce subsystems, and how to define the dynamics. So that's loop quantum gravity. And actually, when I went to see Carlo in Marseille, he showed me the beautiful Calanx and the beautiful weather in Marseille. And then he told me, I'm going to get you to work on spin form models. So spin form models, it's the path integral formulation for loop quantum gravity. So basically, the way I like to see it, it's under the axioms of topological quantum theory by Atiyah and Seagal. A bit like the conformal field theory axioms by Seagal. It's that you're going to look at some initial state, so a 3D manifold, and a final state, a 3D manifold. And you're going to define a cobordism between that and that, which is 4D, the 4D space-time. And so here you have a state or a manifold, a geometry or some discrete geometry, and here the same for the final state. And in the between, you have a 4D manifold or some quantum, your favorite quantum equivalent of the 4D geometry, discrete or quantum. And you give an amplitude to your 4D geometry, such that it is invariant under the symmetries that you want. So the space-time diffeomorphism or some quantum equivalent of that, or in topological quantum theory, simply you want the amplitude to depend only on the overall topology and the topology of the boundary. Okay. Yeah, so I started working on spin forms, and it's where I discovered that the spin forms were related to plenty of things. So I'm not sure what you've seen during your lectures. But one of the formalism that was starting to develop from spin forms, it was group field theories. So group field theories, it's that if you work from spin forms, which are a discrete equivalent of that, you have some basic building blocks of a 4D geometry. So 4D simplices or some elementary 4D block of space-time. And you've quantized that. And then you're trying to build your 4D space-time from these little blocks. And then you're going to give an amplitude to all this configuration of blocks. Then the group field theory, it's simply saying, well, if you have an elementary block of geometry, you're just going to write a field theory of that block. And you're going to generate your transition amplitudes as amplitudes of that field theory. So that's group field theory. And that's some improved version of matrix models. So matrix models as used to generate 2D triangulations and 2D gravity, for example, used in string theory. So, and while this was developing, actually what I worked with Laurent, it was looking at spin forms and adding particle defects to it. And by adding particle defects, so word lines, because if you do gravity without matter, it's kind of empty. So you put particles. And the natural question is, how does the coupling of particles to the quantum geometry is going to affect the dynamics and kinematics of your particles? And so with Laurent, we saw that was related to some non-commutative quantum field theory, or braided non-commutative quantum field theory, so which describes the effective theory for matter once you've integrated out quantum geometry fluctuations due to quantum gravity. Well, there's also some link between this and that. And since I was there, I heard about some field of quantum gravity phenomenology which was developing, which was deformed special relativity or doubly special relativity. So basically, it's the idea that the coupling of matter to the quantum gravity, to quantum geometry, is going to create a deformation of a relativity principle. So for example, if you work in flat space-time, instead of having an invariant to the Poincaré, you're going to look for ways to deform the Poincaré symmetry. So it's something simpler than quantum gravity, where you're trying to deform the diffeomorphism symmetry. So here you're just looking at the Poincaré symmetry, and you try to deform it to into some quantum deformation. So doubly special relativity was based on the kappa deformation of the Poincaré symmetry. And actually, working from spin form to in three dimensions for 3D quantum gravity, the non-quantum theory that we found was exactly some deformation of the Poincaré symmetry in 3D. So that was QG phenomenology, DSR. And this, I stopped working on that, but it developed into relative locality and plenty of other interesting ways to revisit the relativity principle. So where am I on this map? So that was related to non-quantitative geometry, which was, in string theory, they also made a link between matrix models and non-quantitative geometry. So I forgot to put strings somewhere. So it's kind of all linked together. And so when you think about it a bit more, you realize that spin form is related to plenty of other things. So when I studied the structure of spin forms, I had to look at dynamical triangulations. Which was some kind of some particular case of spin forms. There's a lot of questions about causality, and so how causal sets are embedded into spin forms, and also quantum causal histories. And from there, I naturally had to read things on quantum foundations. So, and you realize that if you work in quantum gravity, you have to understand why the quantum, and how you do the quantum to classical transitions. So there's plenty of things on quantum informations and quantum foundations that you have to see. So basically what I'm trying to say is that when you work in quantum gravity, well, my point of view on quantum gravity, that I had to keep the whole picture in mind. Even though I've been working on often some very technical points, I had to keep this big roadmap in my mind to keep my motivation. So to remember that to understand some things in quantum gravity, I have to understand how it's related to the rest, to all these different ideas in quantum gravity. So maybe I should give you some ideas of projects I'm working on, since that's what Maite told me to do. So one of the things I work on is 3D quantum gravity. And more particularly, I look at the boundary of 3D. So 2D boundary theories. So it's almost the same diagram as for spin forms. But here, you have the initial state, which is 2D. You have the final state, which is 2D. But when we talk about boundary theories, it's not this boundary here, it's not the canonical boundary. It's that you're going to look at this boundary here. So the 1 plus 1 boundary. And this work, it's trying to understand holographic dualities in 3D quantum gravity. So how observables on the time-like boundary allows to understand the geometry of the bulk and vice versa. So I work mostly on the spin form models, so Podanoregie and Turay-Viro. And then, so that's 3D. It's because it's a very well-defined mathematical object. But my goal is to understand quantum gravity in 3 plus 1 dimensions, in 4 dimensions of space-time. So I still work on loop quantum gravity. And my main project is to understand the coarse graining of loop quantum gravity. So as you know, in loop quantum gravity, you define the states of quantum geometry, which are spin networks, which define some kind of discrete geometry of space, which basically has a graph on which live some SU2 some elements of the SU2 representation theory. So, and that's supposed to describe the geometry at the Planck scale. Then you have to understand how you coarse grain this geometry, so the geometry and its dynamics, to get to our scales and then to astrophysical and cosmological scales. It's a very hard problem because it's tremendous change of scales. So nothing tells you that the geometry, how you describe it in quantum gravity with spin networks, is the one that we're going to use to describe cosmology. I mean, usually it never happens. I mean, when I go out at pubs and I talk to my friends that ask me questions about physics, I usually tell them about water and how if you look at particles in water, the subatomic particles, they form atoms, and then the atoms of hydrogen and oxygen link into the water molecules, and then there's plenty of different ways that these molecules of water link together to form water, and I discovered that there's plenty of types of snows here, depending on the temperature outside. There's something I didn't know, that when it's really cold, the snow doesn't glue, and you cannot make snowballs. That really troubled me.
You know, it's 100 names of snow. They have 100 different names.
Yeah. I didn't know why. Then I played in the snow. Yeah, and basically for space-time, it's just going to be the same. I mean, you have your spin networks, but you don't know the different ways we are going to this is going to change, the description of geometry is going to change when you change scales. So you could have some condensation of your quantum degrees of freedom. There's plenty of scenarios where it happens. And when you have such condensation or like some kind of big molecules of space-time that could form, you know that you're going to have some phase transitions. And then you're going to have to change your way of describing the geometry. So here I'm trying to see how much loop quantum gravity can be changed to describe quantum geometry from all the scale, from the Planck scale to cosmology, but keeping in mind that how to identify possibilities of phase transitions in loop quantum gravity, and if there's some phase transition, what are the different ways that we could probe the spin network geometry, even if it doesn't exist at the cosmological scale anymore. And then the thing that I'm really trying to understand in my free time, it's all the quantum to classical transition in quantum gravity. So this is something which is more linked to stuff in quantum foundations and quantum information, but which is really trendy these days, where we're trying to interpret all of quantum geometry in terms of quantum information and so on. And the question that particularly interests me, it's the relation between decoherence and holography. So basically my stupid paradox, it's when you're working in quantum gravity, you're supposed to have local degrees of freedom. And if you have local degrees of freedom in your system, if you're looking at some regional space, then you can trace over these local degrees of freedom. And if you look at the boundary theory, then you're going to have some master equation that describes the evolution of your boundary, and it's going to have some interesting decoherence since you trace out on the local degrees of freedom inside. But if you think of holography, that it kind of protects that. So if you have some holography, it means that all your degrees of freedom are not really local inside, and they are all projected on the boundary. So how can you have at the same time some local degrees of freedom that force some decoherence and some protection against decoherence? And in the end, we know that our world is classical here. I'm not very quantum. So there need to be some ways to do some quantum to classical transitions. So trying to think how to accommodate that in loop quantum gravity or in quantum gravity in general, to understand the role of matter and the role of some reformulation of the relativity principle to realize that. So, yeah, to conclude, I can conclude. Yeah. Okay. Beside the fact that everything is interconnected, and that I would encourage you to keep the big picture in mind if you work in quantum gravity. But each time, for each new project, I had to learn plenty of things each time. So I've always been a student, and I still like to find time to sit down and open some books or some chapter of some theory to learn. And each time that I've been working on some new projects, I had to learn new mathematics. Really cool. And each new mathematics opened a whole new field of thoughts for me. Even though a lot of times I realize that all of these things have already been thought about 50 or 100 years ago before, but I can come with a fresher perspective.
We have time for one question.
You should not have erased, but it's okay. You did a great job.
Yeah, I know.
So I'm Laurent Fredel. I've been I've been at PI since the beginning, 3 months after it opened, when there was only moving blackboards and in a bar restaurants and 4 people there. So it's been quite the adventure to see it grow to what it is today. It's been a unique place. And I'm going to follow Etera's lead in how I came to quantum gravity. So I didn't do my PhD in quantum gravity. I was first a mathematician, in fact. I was working in TQFT, topological field theory, Vasilev invariant, things like that, the structure of quantum groups and modular category and defects in modular category. Okay, pure mathematics, and people told me it was completely uninteresting, and why are you doing that? So then I shifted to integrable systems, which was my PhD advisor, where essentially it's very beautiful, there's this beautiful theory, but it did not fulfill me. I felt like I was solving a system because I could solve it, not because there's a, you know, which is essentially the status of the field. And then since then, people have found lots of beautiful applications in condensed matter or other instances where it's very useful to have systems you can solve exactly, but then I got a job and I continued to do math physics, but I realized, I could get much better paid if I was working outside of academia, and it would be much less work than working in academia, so it seemed unfair. So I'm at some point I said, why am I here? Why am I doing academia? You know, if I can get, I can live wherever I want, I can work less and get better paid, right? Essentially the status. So I realized, well, I'm doing academia because I really want to work on the art problem. And I'm like, am I working on the art problem? And I'm like, no, not really. Why? Because I believed it was not really possible to solve this problem. So I was preventing myself from thinking about the art problem. What was the art problem for me? The only two things that were my motivation for doing theoretical physics were solving quantum gravity and the confinement. That's the thing. This is if you're I realize if I'm a theoretical physicist, it's because I want to crack these problems. There's no other reason. If I don't, then I should go and get... Because it's very easy to get a job outside of academia if you're a theoretical physicist. Everybody wants you. So I say, okay, then I decided to move in. It was scary. I said, okay, let's work on quantum gravity. That seems harder than confinement, although I'm not sure. But it seemed at the time, so let's try for the hardest one. And at that time, there was almost nobody... it was not even a field. It kind of started to be a field. There were 2 or 3 people in the world. So then I left my job where I was, and I went doing a postdoc with the crazy guys that were doing pure quantum gravity. Of course, there was string theory there, but for some reason, it was not yet fulfilling me exactly in terms of addressing the question. So that's how I started. And then although I have a gray beard, like Etera, I'm not very far from where you are. Because quantum gravity, I feel, I've been a student, and maybe it took me 20 years of studying, to really get to the point where I feel I can start to have a more holistic pictures, because there's many different techniques, there's many different philosophy that seems conflicting, and it's kind of hard to understand in this network of all ideas what's really relevant and what's really irrelevant, what's technical detail and what's really fundamental ideas, and what are the key fundamental ideas. So I feel, yeah, it took me maybe 20 to 25 years. It's not to discourage you, it's just to express that I'm slow, to kind of get to a simpler picture of what I think is quantum gravity. So that's what I want to talk about today. Last year I gave a talk about my vision of the field of quantum gravity, a bit like what Etera did. And I don't think I could do a better job than I did last year. So if you're interested in that, you can watch the video. I think it's on video. So today, I'm thinking, what am I thinking about when I'm thinking of quantum gravity? I'm thinking about, quantum gravity as the next breakthrough. This is what it's going to be. And why do we have breakthrough in history of physics? I've been a student of the history of physics, too. And anytime there's been a breakthrough, is because you're trying to reconcile a fundamental puzzle, not a convenience puzzle, but something really fundamental. So I was trying to figure out, for me, which one are the fundamental puzzles I want to focus on. Because after studying all this wealth of techniques, they're beautiful, but they're like tools. Right, and in the field of quantum gravity, there's been a tendency to put tools before the ideas, which is what happens, and sometimes the tools are the right one. But it's also good to understand what tools you want to have with respect to the fundamental problem you want to have. And sometimes, people forget that. You learn a tool, and then you keep finding it very useful, and you have your hammer, and then you think everybody can be fixed with your hammer, right? And then. But sometimes you need a screwdriver or something else. Anyway, so what are the fundamental things? So for me, what is quantum gravity? It's something that's supposed to reconcile. The first tension is how can we reconcile the presence of a fundamental length scale? With the relativity principle. I would say if you come up here and you have a way to do that, then to some extent you have a proto-theory of quantum gravity. And there's not really anything fully satisfactory at that stage. So, we know an example, like condensed matter is a good thing, where we understand the theory of what it is to have a fundamental length scale. But of course, the relativity principle is completely broken down. There's a preferred time, there's a preferred place where it happens. So that's the fundamental idea. And of course, if you have a fundamental length scale and you boost it, it shortens. So a priori, it seems impossible. So this is an impossibility, right? Like, think about pre-quantum mechanics. How do you reconcile the concept of particle with the concept of whale? This is impossible. How do you reconcile the notion of magnetic field with the notion of electric field? Put yourself before the reconciliation. It's impossible. So we have been going through these impossibilities. Another way where you can see there's a fundamental conflict in quantum gravity, it's the fact that quantum gravity is kind of reconciling the possibility to curve space, okay, with quantum mechanics. So the curving space is really what gravity is about. And what is a quantum mechanics about? Well, quantum mechanics. One of the key features of quantum mechanics is bond duality. Okay, so what you have in quantum mechanics, you have the principle of complementarity. You can write things in terms of Qs, positions, but you can write things in terms of the conjugate variables, Ps. And you're not losing any information by doing that. And the geometry of the Qs or the geometry of the Ps are exactly the same. So if you want to have a quantum theory of geometry, in some sense, you need to be able to have this exchange of momentum position, but reconcile it with that. Because in gravity, if you think about it, what you have is you have curved space, but you have really flat momenta. So there's a fundamental asymmetry between how you treat one canonical variable versus the other. Okay, and that's the fundamental conflict. Can you reconcile bond duality with the possibility of curving? And then maybe the third fundamental puzzle, which is, in my view, a quantum gravity puzzle, is how do you reconcile the fact that fundamental quantumness, the world is quantum. This is what it is fundamentally, with the fact that we live in a classical world. Okay? Sometimes people call that the measurement problem, but sometimes they mean something else. Space is a classical object, and we want to quantize it, but you can think in the other way. It's like in a quantum thing, how come we have an object that emerged which is so classical, that it's so stable, that at some point we believed for many, many years that it doesn't even have any dynamics, right? So the classical reality, if you think about it, it's essentially space-time. Before you put bearded guys who do measurements in it, right? It's really the classical reality is space-time. So that's really the three fundamental questions, and then any one of the approach that people develop, sometimes they nab at one and or the other, and they or none at all, or they just look at some corners of it. And I mean, the picture I have of these big diagrams of the field is that we're all poking at the elephant, and some people pull the back hand, the front hand, and then they think it's the entire world. But of course, it's going to be a bit more interesting than that. The key things also is that why do you care? So you have to wonder if you really want to devote your life. So what I'm expressing as Etera is that quantum gravity is like when you start and you're really serious about it, it sucks you in because there's so much you have to learn. And it connects so many, and it's kind of the ultimate problems, right? It's the ultimate unifications, if you want. So you're not going to wing it right away, right? So it sucks you in. So you have to be committed. So if you're committed, is why do you care? And this is the reason why there was no field of quantum gravity when I started, because people say, well, we don't care about quantum gravity because there's no phenomenology. So it's all very nice to be able to reconcile that, but the question is, well, can we get something out of it? So if you think about quantum gravity, I think you have to think about what could be the phenomenology of quantum gravity and why. And you have to appreciate that there's almost a no-go theorem, right? So anytime you're in a historical revolution, before the revolution, there's always, not only there's an incompatibility between two things, but this incompatibility has always been rationalized. There are people that have proven that you should not think about it. This is exactly, that it's so, we are so good at rationalizing our system of belief that even in science, right, it's absolutely beautiful to read the literature, and it's so rational. So here, the rationalization is that quantum gravity does not matter. Why it doesn't matter, the rationalization today? It's because we know that we can describe all of physics in terms of effective field theory. Okay? That's the standard modern point of view on theoretical physics today. Relativistic field theory describes everything, and if you want, it's the ultimate organizational principle. And effective field theory is based on a very simple-minded idea, which is separations of scale. Okay? Which, that you can organize, so there's a notion of space and there's a notion of, okay? So this is the rationalization that you should not work on quantum gravity. Okay? So if this, you should not work on quantum gravity because, effective field theory is the ultimate description. What does it mean? It means any new phenomena that you're going to discover in nature, if I'm an effective field theorist, I take my particle physicist hat, this is what I'm going to tell you, Any new phenomena that you want to describe in physics are just going to be I had a higher order operator, a more non-local operator, to your effective description that you already know. And then you can parameterize that and then make all your prediction. And we had a beautiful talk 1 or 2 weeks ago by Michael Trott, with like the world expert on that approach, where now they can accommodate more like the 10,000 or 50,000 terms, right, in the standard model effective Lagrangian. So this is like, okay, we are the masters of that, right? And that guy is absolutely amazing because he can organize all the prediction of the standard model up to order 5. And that means resumming, regauging, reformulating 50,000 terms in the Lagrangian to identify the key parameters. That's effective theory. It's very powerful. And if it is the end of it, then you should not work on quantum gravity, because the scale of quantum gravity is so far away from our scale that there's no way we would ever test it. Okay? So that's the rationale. So if you believe in quantum gravity, if you work in quantum gravity, you have to be crazy enough to say effective theory is wrong. And then you have to face it. For me, it's like facing my fear of not working on the hardest problem. So I'm saying that if I work in quantum gravity, it's because I believe that the effective theory is not the end. And then all of my thinking is about, okay, how do we go through? What is the next principle that allow us to keep the power of effective theory, but just go beyond it? Okay? Especially go beyond this notion of separations of scale. And so any question on that? I mean, how many people, you know, for most people that's the end of it. Like, that's why you don't work on quantum gravity, and that's a good reason. It's a very rational argument.
What's your reason for not believing it?
For?
Not believing it. Not believing it's the end. You have a reason for this?
Yes. Well, as you know, okay, that's a good question in a sense. I'm not sure I want to engage, because it's a question about belief. So it's more, what I'm saying is that, and beliefs are not rational, right? They are anchor points in which you find useful for where you are at the moment. So I'm not going to rationalize the belief. The thing I'm saying is the following, is that if you work in quantum gravity, you better believe that effective theory is dead. Otherwise, you're stupid. Or, I mean, you know, otherwise it means you're working something that you're kind of admitting that what you're going to do is worthless. Okay? So for me, it was an aftermath resolution. You know, I worked in quantum gravity for many, many years, but I realized that's what I really mean. Okay, so now that I realize if quantum gravity is something that is useful or can be demonstrated, that's what I have to focus on. Okay, and then the way research works is that, I mean, research is a little bit like, research is a bit like you front a wall and then you just bang your head for, you know, 2 hours on top of that wall, hoping that it will open up. So why would you do such a painful thing? It's because you have the trust that there's something behind that wall. Okay. So you don't. It's just for me, it's part of my creative process. You don't do what it takes if you don't really believe or have the intuition that there's something behind it. So I'm not going to try to convince you that effective theory is dead, because, you know, it's a perfectly, but if you work in quantum gravity, then you have, and you believe that effective theory is dead, is not dead, then I would say, well, maybe you should do something else more useful. Does that answer your question? Now, I can give you, you know, what did I learn in these 20 years I mean, another reason is that anytime you have a new paradigm that arises, what comes up is not just you're reconciling something, is that you're producing new observables. Okay? So what happens in the belief systems that we have in physics is that any belief systems tells you that certain observables are not possible. And once you change something, then you have new observable that appears, Aronoff-Bohm observable interference patterns, you know, viscosity, for example, non-viscous fluid plane can't fly, so you will not look, you will not look for planes, right? So you first have to find, okay. So now, why do I believe that? Now, I'll go there. There's an idea that I've developed that somehow organizes this how you go beyond effectivity theory. So we heard from Etera that one way, and this is what I thought about for many, many years, that you know one way to think about quantum gravity is that it's really that you should quantize gravity, right? And that's one way to think about it. You know, which essentially means that you have two sides and then you decide that one is stronger than the other and you try to submit one side to the other guy. So here it's like, you know, you're trying to submit the gravity to the quantum. But you could try to do as kind of a gymnastics, you could try to do the other. So the type of methodology I'm using is now I've developed a way to think about what it means to do gravitizing the quantum. Okay, so that's the type of work I'm doing. And then more deeply, the way I think about quantum gravity is it's kind of a, it's not just gravitizing, gravity is only one side of it. It's kind of a deep unification of matter and geometry, a fundamental unification of matter and geometry. Right? And there's also a very interesting no-go theorem. So it's very interesting to look at the no-go theorem. So it goes back to your question. When you're thinking about thinking the impossible, which is equalizing gravity, you have to look very carefully at what are the irrational arguments that people have developed that tells you this is not possible. And here there's a very famous no-go theorem, which is called Kolmann-Mandula. Which says essentially that quantum gravity cannot exist. It's impossible to unify, you know, the gauge group with the Diffeo group. Like there's no such thing that could exist together instead of a split. Okay? So, I mean, we exist. The world is quantum. So clearly, Kolmann-Mandula. It's a theorem, so it's not wrong. But people have missed something about Kolmann-Mandula. So that's another piece of interesting information when you think about quantum gravity as unification. So how do you go around these no-goes? And for me, the driving ideas that has evolved is what I call relative locality. So you have to let go. All these theorems are based on a fundamental hypothesis, which I have to let go. And it's, again, it's always the same thing in history, that the reason it was impossible to think the aftermath, it's because of the implicit. So in any theoretical framework, there's always implicit assumptions that are so obvious that you don't even have a name for them. And because you don't have a name for them, you cannot question them because you don't even know they exist. You don't even know they're framing your entire theoretical framework. So here, what is the hypothesis that we're all making, every single textbook is making today? It's the hypothesis of absolute locality. And that's the one I've been hammering at. And trying to let go. And absolute locality is going to imply separations of scale, and relative locality allow infrared UV mixing naturally as a consequence. So what is absolute locality? Absolute locality, let me phrase it. It's essentially the hypothesis that physicists make that the notion of space-time, is it dependent on the probe you're using. Okay? So the space-time, let's say the sets of points, if you want, is on physical probes. Okay? So it's obvious in phi theory. You said the phi theory, phi, is an object that lives on X. And then what is your goal? Your goal is to take phi and put a hat on phi But of course, you keep the same x. Okay, so this is absolute locality. So now, you know, we found a way to kind of question that hypothesis. So now you phrase it, and you could say, I believe in absolute locality. That's fine. At least you know what you're believing in. And relative locality is now saying, well, no, maybe the notion of locality is really, I don't like to use the word emergent because it's really used in an undefined manner by too many people. But it's the result, you know, it's dependent on the nature of the quantum objects. And in fact, we do have example in condensed matter. So in cases where there is a fundamental length scale, well, and no relativity principle, it's perfectly well known in the quantum Hall effects. It's clear that this quasi-particle and the locality of this quasi-particle have nothing to do with the locality of the interactions. They do interact locally too, but the space in which they interact locally has nothing to do with the space of the laboratory. So we know examples like that, but somehow we have ignored that data. So in condensed matter, when there's a fundamental length scale, we have examples where, in fact, the notion of locality depends on the nature of the probe. And so there's different models you can develop. So this is what I've been kind of nabbing at for the past 7-10 years, is trying to develop the theory where, what I'm saying here is that I understand, for me, the all this reconciliation here, or this unification, it's an extension of the relativity principle that I'm looking at. And relative locality is that extension. I'm not claiming it's fully formulated, but that's kind of the driving idea. It's what's on the other side of the wall. Okay, on the other side of the wall, there's a generalization of the relativity principle that allow me to assign the notion of locality that depends on the nature of the quantum probes that exists. And now we have found example of such. So what is a relative locality is more saying that the interactions of quantum probes defines locality. Okay, so here's the model which I've been developing. And all the models where the notion of locality differs from this absolute notion of locality that I know of have a fundamental length scale. Okay, so relative locality, if you want, you can think of it as an organization principle for non-locality. Go back, the no-go theorem here is separation of scale is really the locality principle. Okay, that there is a notion of space-time, and infrared is very different from ultraviolet. And here, so the type of models we have is, okay, so the first models are very naive. It's like particle-like model where you change, it's the idea, go back to bond duality, you change the structure, the geometry of momentum space, and that modifies the locality. From linear, the geometry of momentum space is linear addition. Another thing that it's you look at a defect in quantum geometry. Okay, so the theory of edge modes. This is this kind of condensed matter type of pictures. So you can have in certain system we know exactly what is the quantum geometry, so quantum states, and then you can poke defects at it. And these defects they behave and they interact in a way which is not the classical interactions, but you can say what kind of locality they define, and then in some cases you can work it out. This is the quantum geometry. And the third thing is that you can also change the nature of the probe, and you can go from particle to string. Okay, and you can ask what is the notion of locality, which is defined by interactions of string. And we found a new type of geometry that we call modular geometry that realized that. And this type of geometry, it's beautiful because it allows you to understand how to go around Kalman-Mandula. So to go around Kalman-Mandula, you have to leave. You have to find a proper generalization of what you call symmetry. And it turns out that mathematicians have done that. So the usual notion of symmetry are Lie algebras. The new notion of symmetry that now we are studying and I'm working on, which is realized to a notion of geometry that appears in generalized geometry, is based on what's called Lode algebra. And this is extremely rich. So there's a new category of, it's like what happened in 1860 when Lie invented Lie algebras. We are now at the verge of inventing a new notion of symmetry. And it turns out that this new notion of symmetry allow you to go around Kullmann-Mandula and appears in this, allow you to kind of formalize what relative locality is.